The next case on our calendar is 08-1451, State of Ohio versus Midway Motor Sales, Inc. Mr. Carpenter.
May it please the court. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. I am Mike Carpenter, and together with my partners, Angie Paul Whitfield and Jeff Lipson, I'm pleased to be here today to represent GMAC in this very important case, not only to my client, but to all finance and banking companies who operate in the state of Ohio in the area of automobile leases. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time, if I could, Your Honor. Your Honor, the issue before this court is whether my client, GMAC, gave true and complete odometer disclosures as required by Ohio Revised Code Section 4549.46. The answer is absolutely yes, for three reasons. First of all, the record evidence below shows indisputably that we gave those true and complete odometer disclosures. Second, the plain language of 4549.46 shows there is a knowledge element to that claim. And third, the legislative history of that statutory scheme shows that there was a belief, a knowledge element that was included in that statute. We turn to the record evidence first. It is undisputed that GMAC had no knowledge of Midway Motors' odometer fraud in this case. The Ohio Attorney General has admitted that. The trial judge so found. It is undisputed that GMAC uncovered Midway Motors' odometer fraud and reported it to the Attorney General. The Attorney General has so admitted. It is undisputed that the vehicles that were leased by Midway Motors were not in the possession of GMAC, but in fact, the leases had been assigned to GMAC after Midway Motors had leased them to another entity. While in the possession of Midway Motors, those odometers were tampered with by Midway. It is undisputed that GMAC, with the knowledge and blessing of the Attorney General of Ohio, set out after uncovering this fraud, advised the Attorney General, and remediated and made whole to the tune of $1.2 million consumers that were affected.
That's a small point, but the Attorney General said they didn't bless it.
Well,
they acquiesced, I guess.
Acquiesced, I guess. They told us to go forth and make the consumers whole, Your Honor.
Yep. Your point is you could do this. I mean, your client can do it, and Attorney General didn't object to it. Your client, that's one of the equitable arguments you make, obviously, is that your client did everything here, it seems, that was a good corporate client or good corporate entity to seek out the owners of the vehicles and to give them compensation for the fact that their odometers have been rolled back.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, does this all turn on knowledge and whether or not that matters? Is that what the case turns on?
Well, in part, Your Honor, in part.
And with respect to that part, there is knowledge and there's knowledge. It's you don't have to live very long to know that there are folks operating in the automobile business that get the reputation of having awfully youthful cars on their lots. Now, you don't know that, but upon reasonable investigation, you could know that. So I guess what I'm wondering is if we follow what you're suggesting, which I don't think is unreasonable, how do we draw that so that you can't just have a blind eye? If you're, whether you're General Motors or whoever you are, when you're dealing with somebody else who has had possession and turns cars back or, you know, routes them back out to new unsuspecting buyers.
Your Honor, first of all, I think the court understands that in the record evidence before this court, there's absolutely no question, no dispute that my client, GMAC, did not have knowledge.
I understand that.
And I understand.
But what we write is going to affect the whole trade.
I understand, Your Honor. I think what we have to do in this case is look at what the statute says and, more importantly, what the registrar's form of affidavit says. And it says, to the best of my our knowledge, this is the actual mileage. This is no different than any other case, I think, in which if you have a particular entity that has signed that sworn affidavit in that form, and in fact they had that knowledge, depending on how this court wants to view it, how the prosecutor, the jury, the judge wants to view it, then it's no different than any other knowledge element case that you might have prosecuting in any other respect. So I don't see this as any different with respect to the elements of the violation than in any other aspect.
But counsel, there's a discrepancy between the registrar's certificate of transfer here, the odometer disclosure affidavit, and how the statute is being read, and you're imputing knowledge based on primarily this odometer disclosure affidavit, which anybody who sells a car doesn't have the option of what form they're going to fill out. They have to fill out this odometer affidavit, correct?
It's mandated by the state. You're given no option. What you are given, though, is the option to check a different box.
Right. The mileage stated is in excess of the mechanical limits.
That's correct. And there's a third box, Your Honor. The odometer reading is not the actual mileage. So there is a third box. And this form, however, drives you or moves you to the first box when you have no knowledge, as my client
did. And I understand that. And I'm thinking that maybe there needs to be a third box that says that affiant is the owner was not in possession of the vehicle in order to, you know, and that would be up to the department, the registrar, in conjunction with maybe the legislature on how they would fashion that. But given the limitations of the document that was put before this seller and every other seller, there were no options here.
There were no options. If you had no knowledge, you had one option, and that was to sign, to the best of my our knowledge, this is the actual mileage. And my client truthfully signed that, and that's the problem here, Your Honor. There is no question. The only way to find my client in violation is to erase those seven stubborn words, as I like to call them. And you can't erase them from the record. That's not what we're about here. They've erased those seven words. And at the top of the form, it's not lost on me as I was getting ready to come in here today, it actually says in the state form that erasures and alterations void this title assignment. So by taking those seven words out of my client's affidavit, you have effectively altered this form and avoided this assignment. There is no basis for having gone forward, and there's no basis on the record evidence in this case for having found my client in violation of this odometer situation.
Well, the statute 40, 45, 49, 46A says that no transferor shall fail to provide a true and complete odometer disclosure. And I guess Mr. Carney's strongest point would be that your client did.
His strongest point would be that my client provided the disclosure in the form, as you go on, Your Honor, to say required by section 450506 of the revised code. I think Mr. Carney's strongest point would be the only way he can succeed is if this court reconciles the irreconcilable.
Okay.
If this court, that's his argument, that he claims this is strict liability.
Yes.
We say it's not.
Right.
And we say by importing 450506 in the form prescribed, it makes it quite clear that there is a knowledge element here. The state is aware of that.
If we would agree that it was strict liability, why would your client not fall under the exclusion, as referenced in the third proposition of law, that the transferor of a motor vehicle is not in violation if the odometer reading is incorrect due to a previous owner's violation?
I totally agree.
Unless the transferor knows or recklessly disregards facts. Clearly, your client didn't know. Why wouldn't that exception, I mean, if we would agree with the Attorney General that this should be strict liability, why doesn't your client fall under that exception provided in the statute?
We clearly believe we do. That's why we assign it as another assignment of error, both here and at the Court of Appeals. What the Attorney General argues, though, is they took seven words out of my affidavit. Now they want to put seven words into the statute. They say, must be the owner at the time of the tampering.
But the statute doesn't say,
it doesn't say that.
Tampering had to occur while the previous owner was a titled owner of the vehicle. That's not in this statute. It just says action of a, it says incorrect, due to a previous owner's violation of any of the provisions contained in 45, 49, 42 to 46 of the code. So there isn't any reference to the time at which the violation occurred.
Absolutely correct. I totally agree with you, Your Honor. And to add those seven words to that statute, I think, belies the weakness of the case. I think it shows that on its face, this statute would have exonerated my clients in this instance and on this record.
I had the same question to Justice, and of course, Mr. Carney is going to give us he'll have a chance to vigorously argue against this point as he did in his brief, but you didn't argue this, as you say, it was your third point in your brief and didn't argue it very strongly. Is it because you don't think it's a very, I had the same question. I mean, literally, if you take the language literally, Midway was the previous owner, and although it changed the mileage after GMAC owned the cars, it was the previous owner. And if you take the words literally, it'd be like someone breaking in, I suppose, that somebody who sells a car to trades in a car and to the dealership and breaks in and think, oh my gosh, I'm gonna change that, and they break in and they, you know, whatever, they change the odometer after the title transfers. But statute, I think probably the implication is the statute assumes that the previous owner has possession of the automobile when he or she changes the odometer, but the literal words don't say that.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And
did you think that was not a very strong argument?
Oh, we thought it was a powerful argument, but we also thought it was powerful that my client signed true and complete affidavits and that they were asking us to remove it. We also thought it showed the importation of the knowledge element through the registrar, and more importantly, from a matter of this court's concern about what's going on in Ohio, all of us who are selling, transferring, trading in cars are signing the same form under the same mistaken belief that when we say to the best of our knowledge, it's exactly what it means. We're not assuming that those are going to be erased later under strict liability theory.
This case is different than the cases in which we've held, as you know, a long line of cases in which we consistently say that an administrative rule, if it's inconsistent with a statute, can't control. This is a little different here, where somebody, that's the only form and they have to rely on, the statute refers to the authority of the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. What's your response to our line of case? How do we distinguish this case from other cases?
I think this case, Your Honor, there's a clear statutory directive to another part of a statute that's incorporated here. This isn't simply a delegation in the sense of go do something. This is empowering the registrar to go form in 450506, and in fact in the introductory portion of 4505, to tell them to go and create the form that they must do. 4505-06A1 says application for certificate of title shall be made in a form prescribed by the Registrar of Motor Vehicles. We don't consider that a administrative delegation. I consider that a statutory empowerment. The same way when we look at 4505-06C1, the registrar shall prescribe an affidavit in which the transferor shall swear to the true selling price and the true odometer statement. I believe those, Your Honor, are direct statutory empowerments that the legislature intended for the registrar and the Bureau of Motor Vehicles to engage in. So we believe that is different than when you're promulgating administrative rules to provide people with guidance as to what they should do. Here also, there's only one form of affidavit that any of us can sign in the state of Ohio, and we are given those three options that Justice O'Connor referred to earlier. So I think this is a pretty clear-cut case under either our first assignment of error, Your Honor, or under the previous owner defense, that you can't take seven words out and you can't put seven words into the statute in order to make my client, which, by the way, I want to mention this, the FBI has designated my client a victim of Midway Motors odometer fraud. And so I stand here before you as a victim faced with the state of Ohio saying, because you signed these forms truthfully, you are now going to be made the subject of one of our lawsuits. We have asked, and I hear this argument, why this is up to the legislature. Well, the Court of Appeals, the 10th District, didn't say that. They said they felt their hands were tied by precedent but they said that they believed that a higher court was going to need to fix what has occurred in this situation. And so
better yet, the General Assembly, perhaps.
Or the General Assembly, perhaps. But I say to this court, the General Assembly and the Registrar has had this form on the books for a great many years. We have advised them. This case has been pending for 4 years. We have pointed out this discrepancy. It's still being used. This court needs to make a clear ruling that will either put an end and send a signal to the misapplication of the law by the lower courts of appeal, or make the legislature understand that the way this law is written, that it does have a mental element. And then if they want to make some changes, then it's up to the legislature.
How extensive an opinion, then, do you think needs to be written in a case like this? If we would agree with a statutory exception, for example, we could conclude it that way. But it seems to be that you're arguing we ought to address all of the propositions in terms of the strict liability and implications imposed from the use of the affidavit prescribed by the Bureau of Motor Vehicles.
I had my preference.
Pardon me?
If I had my preference, I would have you address them all, because I think this state needs that clarification. I think outside of my client speaking now on behalf of myself as a consumer, I don't know how this previous owner defense is going to work in my situation. I know how it works in GMAC situation, and I think that is a commercially reasonable fix to the facts of my client.
If we determine that this is a strict liability statute, what is the impact of that decision on the affidavit that's currently being used by the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, in your view?
The affidavit is clearly entrapment. That was our second assignment, and I don't think there's any question, and I don't think there's any question now, that it's an entrapping document put out by the state of Ohio with knowledge aforethought that they, perhaps this court, but they are using this affidavit to get citizens like GMAC or myself or perhaps members of this court to sign on, and then they're claiming those seven words are gone and now we're going to prosecute.
Oh, but the Bureau of Motor Vehicles who prepared the form, they're not trying to get people to lie on a form, are they?
They
just interpreted the statute and said there's a knowledge requirement. That's not entrapment, is it?
I believe it is entrapment when you continue to do it with knowledge that this form says upon knowledge. When Debbie Couch from the Bureau of Motor Vehicles says that it's upon knowledge that this transfer has to occur, this disclosure. So I believe that they are on notice at this time and have been for some time. We've explained this discrepancy to them some time ago. And so I believe that they should have looked at this, they should have addressed this in a prospective fashion. They have not. And I certainly applaud this court for having given us the chance to get this problem fixed.
You're concerned with the difference between the application by the Attorney General's office and the application by the Bureau of Motor Vehicles in terms of how this statute on the odometer disclosure is being reported.
That's right, Your Honor. If we apply it the way the Bureau of Motor Vehicles does, pursuant to the statutory authority, and apply it that way, I think everything will work out just fine, certainly for GMAC in this case, but also for the citizens of Ohio. It's this misuse of this form and this disclosure statute that has created the problem for us.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carney.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. Nothing we've heard so far about the facts or the form changes the fact that the disclosure law is a strict liability statute for three reasons. First, the previous owner exception does have an express mental state, meaning that the general rule can't have a mental state as well, or that exception becomes meaningless. Second, every other violation in the odometer law for tampering, auctioneers, sale itself, everything except the form, the disclosure requirement, has an express mental state, showing the contrast is deliberate. And finally, this is a consumer law. And so the only way to make consumers whole is to make sure that every defendant is at the table so that we can achieve the kind of remediation that doesn't leave consumers.
But we have a statute on the books that clearly says when no mens rea is indicated, it's reckless. And you want us to take the opposite conclusion on this statute, because there's no mens rea, even though they may mention in other parts of the statute. Therefore, it's strict liability. That goes against all our case law.
No, it doesn't at all, Your Honor, because this court has said in WAC, in Fairbanks, in Collins, in every case, the court has said we don't require magic language. The legislature doesn't have to say and this is strict liability, or and no knowledge is required, the court has said you look to plain indication. And in WAC, the court looked at the fact that within the statute, one line said, no one shall knowingly do X, and then the next one said, no one shall do Y. And the court said, gee, when you put that knowingly in the one line and not the other, that's deliberate. And here we have that, because the first line says, don't do this. The second law says, but we'll cut you a break if a previous owner did it, and if you're not reckless about it or knowing.
Then why do we bother with this affidavit if it's strict liability? There's no value, there's no purpose to the affidavit.
A couple of answers to that, Your Honor. First, if the affidavit is a problem, and that's an administrative, not a statute, the court, if it says so, then yes, the BMV would have to change it if this court says so. But keep in mind, the way you should review this is to look at both statutes. The BMV statute, not the form. Pretend the form just said the mileage is with no other clause. Pretend that for a second. See how you'd view our statute. And if you'd view that statute as strict liability, then bringing the form in cannot trump a statute. The form cannot trump a statute.
There's a definite inconsistency in your argument, then, between what you're arguing strict liability in the statute and the knowledge element promulgated by the Bureau of Motor Vehicles in the affidavit.
Your Honor,
isn't that
not
true?
Between the two statutes at all. And I want to point
not
out
the
a couple
statute.
Of
the inconsistency is between your argument that we have a strict liability statute and an affidavit that requires a knowledge element.
Well, what it does is by saying you have to fill this out and is that you have to go out of your way to do the due diligence to make sure it's right. And as the court below noted, if they had just asked GM or Midway to get the modern builder's record, the consumer that was using the cars on a lease, they could have discovered this. But there's a worse inconsistency here if you go their way. Even if there's a difficulty between the form and the statute, they've never answered this. Let's say you grant both their propositions. You give them that they're strict liability, and you also give them that they're in the prior owner scenario. What then would be the standard to apply to their case on remand, since we won on summary judgment? If you say that there's a knowledge requirement, that second sentence definitely becomes, not part of the time, but all the time, irrelevant. You'd never reach the previous owner exception, because if you say knowledge is the requirement up here, even if you had someone who was undeniably reckless, someone the legislature wanted to impose liability on, because that second sentence says, if you're reckless, even if you're a victim of a previous owner, if you're reckless, you're back on the hook.
You've stipulated that GM had no knowledge in this case. Am I correct?
Exactly, Your Honor, and we think we can possibly show recklessness, and if we can.
You think they didn't know about it, but they may have been reckless.
Exactly. And
so that's why you think the second sentence of 45, 46, the transferor of a motor vehicle is not in violation of this division requiring a true odometer reading. If the odometer is incorrect due to a previous owner's violation, unless the transferor knows of, which you say they didn't, or recklessly disregards facts indicating the violation.
Correct. Now, we think because we don't think they do qualify for the previous owner exception, that even if they're below reckless, even if they're just negligent, we think strict liability does impose liability here. But here's the more important part. They can't answer this question. If you say that recklessness applies to them, then they're all of a sudden having an inconsistency where all the other people who were victimized by a mechanic who rolled back the thing because he took it on a joyride over the weekend, you'd have to say everybody is subject to the knowledge requirement, unless you're victimized by a prior owner, in which case you might be held liable for recklessness. That creates a two-tier standard where the people victimized by a prior owner actually get it worse. Then they'd want to get back out of that exception. But on the other hand, if you say, nope, everyone's knowledge, if you're reckless, nobody, whether you're victimized by a lessee or your kid takes it on the weekend with a friend and rolls it back, whatever, if you say everybody's held to a knowledge standard, then that second sentence could never, ever, ever come into play. And the legislature went out of its way in 1989 when this exception used to say knowledge. They went out of their way to add recklessness, to say we want people who are reckless, even if they're victimized by a previous owner, to be on the hook. That can literally never come into play in their case or any other hypothetical. You can't come up with a set of facts that preserves the meaning of that second sentence if you go their way.
In your brief, you argued that the exception doesn't apply because there's an element that it had to have been done while the previous owner owned the vehicle, but that doesn't seem to be in the language of this exception.
Two comments.
How do you read that in?
First, when you say if the violation was done by the owner, that means by the owner. And when they did it,
it
they
says,
didn't have that hat on.
No, it says so, due to a previous owner's violation.
Right, but it's
without
not,
any reference to time.
Well, it also doesn't say regardless of time. And by saying no owner's violation, a couple of points, Your Honor. First, if you do find for some reason they fit within that exception, it'd be far better to say yes, there's strict liability, but they're in the exception, which means they could, we'll see whether they're reckless or not. It'd be far better to do that than to try to say there's knowledge across the board and grant them their first proposition. Because if you grant them their first proposition, no doubt about it, you're taking the second sentence and throwing it out the window. And this court has never said that not only can a form or an administrative practice trump a statute, but that you can actually eliminate part of the language of a statute because of a form. And second, why they shouldn't fall within the previous owner is because the legislature was recognizing that an owner has more control over their car, that even if I might be in trouble if, again, I leave it for the weekend with a mechanic, they drive to Indianapolis and back and then roll it back to cover it up or whatever bizarre scenario, they're recognizing that, yes, some people are held strictly liable unless you're in this one scenario. And under their view, if you had two different mechanics who messed with two different people's cars and everything was identical except one mechanic in a small town used to own the car 12 owners ago back in the 80s, that person gets the exemption.
Oh, but you're,
and that makes no sense.
You can't, you're not trying to deny that the words previous owner literally, if you take it literally, can mean the previous owner who, in this situation, who was a lessor of the car, took the car back and changed the odometer reading after GMAC became the owner. You're not, I mean, you can't.
I think they meet the term owner, but when you say due to an owner's violation, because it's in the possessive, an owner's violation, it wasn't when they did it an owner's violation. If I say whether something was caused by a minor, the fact that someone used to be a minor doesn't change the fact that, well, when it happened, that's what was their status. And the status has to be tied to when it happens. But if the court rules against us on that reason, that would be far, even though we oppose that, that would be better than gutting this exception totally by saying, and again, they cannot reconcile whether they'd be held to a recklessness standard or whether they'd be held to a knowledge standard. They're having it both ways.
Let me ask you a question that doesn't go to the merits here, but what would the state's position be? You'd have to accept it, obviously, but what would your position be if we were to hold that the statute as it's written is a strict liability statute, but our decision is prospective only? I'm very concerned about this affidavit because there is direct authority to BMV to create a form, which is unlike some administrative rules, as you know. The agency has general authority to adopt rules, but here it's a very direct, there's one form, everybody uses it, they all think if they sign this form, that's all I have to do. And it's really, there's not entrapment issue.
That,
is
Your
not,
Honor. First, I don't think this court's jurisprudence about when you create exceptions to prospective application or retrospective only, I'm not aware of anything in the jurisprudence that gives an out here. But more importantly, if you hold that this is strict and say, but this form is a problem, one, the form would have to go out. I admit that. The form would have to change if this court says the form is not compatible with the statute. Just like in Hoffman, administrative practice or even an administrative reg yields to a statute. Second, it would be basically prospective in the sense that no one else is ever going to get in trouble again if the BMV the morning after changes it. And third, it doesn't really leave them with harm because the trial judge here very wisely, in our view, in retrospect, said, you know, I have this mandatory shall language, so I'm going to find strict liability and impose a penalty, but I'll use my equitable power to suspend it. So the penalty
it shifts the battle into the General Assembly where it should be.
$0. But if you go with striking down our statute, not only are you warping our statute, but then the Assembly has to get it all together. If you say the administrative side is the problem, that can be changed overnight with an administrative change.
Now, and your prosecutor has, the Attorney General has prosecutorial discretion, do they not?
Yes.
I guess the question that's burning in all of our minds, certainly in my mind, is why in the world, when they are a good corporate citizen and fix the problem, do you go after them?
Couple of answers, Your Honor, and I understand. When I first looked at this case, I had the same question, and then I found out because we wanted to have everyone at the table to order remediation. At the time, we weren't sure all the cars had been recovered and that every consumer was satisfied. You have a bankrupt Midway, and keeping them at the table, for as much as they tout their remediation efforts, if you take their view of the law, the next person in their shoes could just say, we're not going to spend a penny, and you can't touch us. The court can only use its remedial power to make sure there's rescission.
You use them basically as an example
No, to keep them on, to keep people not only liable, to cover, making sure every last consumer is covered here, and yes, in future cases.
Why don't you just wait till you had a case where the corporate defendant didn't do any remediation and then go after him instead of somebody who did?
Because, Your Honor, one, we weren't sure the remediation was complete, and so it's a way to make sure every last I is dotted.
Did you ever say, here's a car we found, and go take care of it, too, because it took care of, I don't know, 70-some cars?
Didn't, Your Honor, but keep in mind, once the trial court shaved the penalty, we've been totally on defense since then. Once the trial court said, yes, it's a technical violation, $0, 0 cents, we'd have been happy, you know, but they appealed it. So we defend an appeal because then we don't want case law that says all sorts of other miscreants can get away even if they're reckless. We don't want people who are reckless to get away with this. We want to hold people, even if they're negligent, to strict liability. And we also have a statute that says that there's an exception only for this one scenario. And if they fit in that exception, fine, so be it. We don't think they do for the reasons I stated. But if you really go their way, they cannot come up with any scenario where that second sentence will have any meaning. Because if everyone's subject to knowledge, the recklessness never comes into play, and what you're saying is that when the legislature added that in 1989, it had no effect because there was knowledge across the board. So adding an amendment, the legislature, you know, just whiffed at that. They swung and missed.
I don't understand why you, I'm having a hard time understanding why the second sentence that you keep referring to doesn't come into play. If they say best of their knowledge and they were reckless about that knowledge issue, that comes
into play.
Because,
Your Honor, knowledge and recklessness are, of course, two different things. I believe Justice Lanziger's concurrence a couple months ago in Clay did a nice job explaining how, even if they're sometimes hard to sort out, knowledge is higher than recklessness. And if they say you can't touch anyone unless you clear the full knowledge hurdle, then no, someone between reckless and knowledge, even if in that second sentence, is never going to get past the first sentence.
I don't follow that argument. You can sign an affidavit, the best of my knowledge, and be reckless as all get out as to what you really do know.
Well, if the court tries to say that the recklessness is about whether you found out the knowledge as opposed to the signing, that doesn't quite match the statute because it says if your recklessness regarding the true odometer reading or are reckless about the facts that lead or that would have shown you the violation. And so if you're reckless, you should be on the hook. And so if the court finds a way to get there, that's fine, but that can't be squared with a true knowledge unless it's knowledge minus a little.
You could be lying about your knowledge. You could be lying about your knowledge. That's reckless. Just because you signed it and said it's true knowledge doesn't mean that statement is true.
Well, if you say, to the best of my knowledge, this is the true odometer reading, we believe the truth goes not to your state of mind, but to the actual reading on the piece of paper. And that's from the clause that says a true odometer reading, not a true subjective intent. But I also want to point out that they cite in their brief, page 9 of their reply, this language counsel referred to about how the legislature added this knowledge discussion. He's right. They did. In 1983, they added it in 77. They kept it in the 1983 law he cites. But the reason he doesn't cite the current statute for that is because the legislature took it out. They actually had language in the BMV statute that says, to the best of my knowledge, they took it out and just said, well, whatever form the BMV director says or the registrar says. So he's trying to rely on statutory history when actually that history has been wiped out, which, if anything, helps us, not them. And the legislature then not only took that language out of the one statute, they put language in the other statute saying, and we mean recklessness here. Again, whatever you do with the facts of their case, this law is a strict liability law. It has every hallmark of the statute, the standards that this court has found in other statutes. Not only this, but all the other pieces of this law say, no one shall knowingly do this, no one shall recklessly
counsel,
do that.
Counsel, the facts of this case are a little bothersome, considering that Midway purposely, you know, told GMAC, you know, finance this whole thing for me, and then went behind their backs and made a secret agreement with the construction company that, you know, GMAC only wants you to put on 30,000 miles, but it's okay with us, and, you know, you can put on 100,000 miles or whatever the mileage was.
No doubt Midway's got, they're the ones with the black hat here.
Right, but they went bankrupt, and they're, you know, off someplace. How often has the Attorney General witnessed this type of collusive deception?
I'm not aware of any case that comes near this convoluted circumstance. But I am aware that if you say this law always requires knowledge, there are a lot of negligent and reckless people that we're worried we couldn't catch. Like in all the many appeals court cases that went our way, we don't want to lose the strict liability standard, not least of which because the legislature said so, but we'd rather see the strict liability upheld. And again, they face no dollar penalty here. Everything they did in remediation, as much as we like good corporate citizens, they could have said, we won't do a darn thing. If you find in their favor on their first proposition, every future person in their shoes could just say, well, let the consumer hold the bag.
Would you agree that this is an area of the law that the legislature should revisit and maybe modify to be more in keeping with what business practices are in the automotive industry, the lease portion of it and the financing portion of it?
I think recognizing that a possessor of a car and that the phrase owner in there technically covers the person holding the piece of paper, the title, I can see why some people would think the legislature should act. I can also see why the legislature might want to say, on the other hand, even if you're negligent, maybe your penalties should be less or something, but we might want to still have you there to get rescission. Give the car back, get your money back. Otherwise, if you've got, unfortunately, the bad guy's gone, the consumer's left holding the bag. So as between the consumer and holding a GMAC or another dealer in that situation or a titled owner liable to at least order rescission, and a trial judge's broad equitable powers can say, you know what, we won't find damages.
And that's all civil remedy. This is a criminal.
No, this is civil,
well,
Your Honor.
But there's criminal consequences that flow from a finding here.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but when you come to the criminal side of it, keep in mind, if it's an individual that actually has that knowledge, that's one thing. If a corporation has knowledge, no one's going to put the corporate entity in prison, of course. Only people can go to prison. And so what a corporation is going to face in these large cases with a whole fleet of 70 cars is give back the car, give their money back.
So you're saying the corporate officer never could face a criminal penalty?
Well, only if you can find that they personally had this degree. And if you find that they have recklessness, then yes. And if a corporate officer is reckless, then officer is negligent, then I think they could perhaps invoke with a jury trial or perhaps the rule of lenity would apply. There might be differences in criminal cases. We don't have prosecutorial authority criminally. We take in the civil matter. So you'd have to ask the county prosecutors whether they would prosecute here. But we think it's civilly important for us to have this tool to get consumers' money back. I also want to finish in answering about the legislature
and whether
they should act. I know I'm over time, but if the BMV acts, the legislature might not have to. And if this court says so, all can be made well without endangering the consumers who would otherwise be left holding.
How would you suggest the Bureau of Motor Vehicles act here? By eliminating the seven words that were referenced and just make it, I certify that the odometer reads?
They could add another box saying, you know, I'm sure or I'm not so sure. There may be any number of ways, but the bottom line is this court has never said an administrative practice can trump a statute. You should review this case the way you would without the form, then bring the form back in and say, can that trump what we would otherwise do? And if the answer is no, then you can't go their way without erasing your prior precedent in the field. We ask you to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. Mr. Carpenter, you've used your time, but you may take a minute.
I will take 1 minute. Thank you, Your Honor. It's a fourth-degree felony to answer the question on the penal. To answer the question on that I heard, and I don't blame Mr. Carney for this. He wasn't there when I approached the Attorney General and dealt with this over the years. But you should know that the suit was filed after we had remediated all 85 consumers. Justice Stratton, there was no reason for them to go forward on this, and they knew that. I would like, and there was no basis.
This was filed in 2004, is that?
2005, Your Honor.
2005. Okay.
I would like to say also that with respect to the affidavit, it's on the back of every car title. This is not the odometer form. It's on the back of transferring of car titles. I would also like to point out that when he says that, and Justice O'Donnell, this is a problem that I've gotten. I've heard it today, and now I'm very troubled. He says that under the previous owner defense, they can go back and prosecute us, in this case, for acting recklessly. There's not the word reckless is not used in their complaint that was filed against GMAC, and I think that is absolutely disingenuous to tell this court that. They did not accuse us of recklessness. They claim that this was strict liability right from the beginning, and there was no exception. So I want this court to be very cautious. I think you should order this case reversed and that this decision, as you know, on summary judgment, you can now issue a decision and a mandate that exonerates my client. I am very concerned, given the discretion I've seen so far, that we're going to go back and face the same thing if you only use the previous owner exception. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.